Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an interview with Kate Breslin of SCAA about a bill to reduce childhood poverty that just passed the legislature. Then, for our peace segment, we talk with Ed Kanaan about upcoming trials over protest arrests against drones at Hancock Air Force Base. After that, we hear from Megan Keegan about her Democratic Party primary for the Albany Common Council in the 9th Ward. We then hear from Trayvon Jackson of the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region about Albany's upcoming Juneteenth celebration. And we finish with Black Lives Matter activist Muhammad Abdi about the politics of race and activism in Vermont. But first, headlines.
The New York State Bar Association has issued a report concluding that Governor Cuomo's directive for New York nursing homes to admit COVID-19 patients increased the death toll among residents. The lengthy report by the Bar Association also faulted Cuomo for not reversing the Department of Health's unreasonable mandate sooner than he did, saying it remained in effect weeks longer than necessary.
After one of Cuomo's most trusted aides and closest friends, Joseph Prococo, was convicted of soliciting and accepting more than $300,000 in bribes from executives with businesses before the state, the governor quickly publicly distanced himself. However, the New York Times reports that privately, members of the governor's inner circle, including one of his sisters, have for years been quietly raising money for Prococo to pay his legal bills and support his family.
The Gazette reports that students with disabilities enrolled in special learning programs who reached the age 21 during the pandemic would be able to remain in their programs until the age 23 rather than aging out of public education under legislation that passed the Assembly and Senate last week.
The Rensselaer County Legislature approved a resolution to create the Rensselaer County Recovers Fund, $1.2 million out of an $18 million surplus for the county in 2020 will be used to fund it. The funding will initially assist volunteer, fire, and ambulance companies with expenses related to the COVID-19 response, and as well as dealing with a reduction in revenues and fundraising in other areas. The remainder of the funds will be used for youth and community organizations.
The Times Union reported that the state assemblywoman, Mary Beth Walsh of Saratoga, posted and then deleted a satirical tweet that said Tuesday night's fireworks display over the Empire State Plaza would muffle the sound of gunfire in Albany. Albany experienced an especially deadly May with 6 homicides, including gun violence.
Kenneth Knutson, a Schoharie judge since 2002, has resigned amid a judicial investigation into his, in quotes, abhorrent and inimical Facebook posts that revealed his bias against the LGBTQ community and Muslims and pro-police view, the State Commission on Judicial Conduct said Wednesday. That's it for the headlines.
And for our first segment this evening, the New York State Legislature has passed a Childhood Poverty Reduction Act to reduce it by 50% in the state in the next decade. Kate Breslin of the Schuyler Center for Analysis and Advocacy discusses the bill with Mark.
We're joined today by Kate Breslin, who's the president of the Schuyler Center for Analysis and Advocacy. And while many activist groups were not exactly satisfied with what happened at the end of the legislative session this year, there was good news with respect to the Child Poverty Reduction Act being passed. So Kate, maybe you could briefly discuss, what is the extent of the problem of childhood poverty in New York, and why was this bill important to that effort?
Thanks for having me, Mark. So child poverty is a problem across New York State. Almost one in five children live in poverty. So that means that they're, for a family of four, their income is around $26,000 a year. And there, if you look at the number of kids who are still in families that are struggling to make ends meet, but maybe just above poverty, that number almost doubles. So almost 40% of our kids living, you know, at or near poverty. And why is it a problem? It's a problem because we know that family income is really directly tied to longer term health outcomes and other concerns. So a child who grows up in poverty is more likely to have poorer health outcomes, challenges in school, and challenges later in life. So it's a problem both for the child, the family, and for our community. And there are public costs associated with it. And while New York likes to think of itself as a leader in so many ways, a child is more likely to live in poverty in New York than in 32 other states. So we really need to take a look at how do we start to address this.
Now, you mentioned that childhood poverty is a statewide problem. And I know some people sometimes just say, oh, this is New York City, particularly the Bronx. But, you know, Buffalo and Rochester consistently rank among the worst big cities in the country for poverty. And then I always cite particularly Schenectady has an extremely high childhood poverty rate, as do certainly neighborhoods in Albany and Troy. But it's also, poverty is also a problem in rural upstate New York as well. So what will this bill actually do to help reduce childhood poverty in New York?
Thanks for raising that, because we agree, and the data is clear that, yeah, it's a problem in rural, urban, and suburban communities. And also that sometimes, you know, if you only look at county level numbers, that you miss, as you said, sort of certain communities within counties or even within cities where poverty is a problem. And you called out Rochester and Buffalo, where almost half of the kids live in poverty. What the bill does is it sets a goal of cutting child poverty in half in the next 10 years, and then creating a process and a pathway to explore the ways to do that. And it's written in a way that's flexible enough and brings in representatives and representation from different parts of the state, so that while some of the kind of interventions and solutions might be statewide, there may be others that are regional or more targeted to different types of communities, be that rural, urban, suburban. So it's written in a way that, you know, there's a goal, there's measurement against the goal, and then some flexibility about how to get there.
Now, politicians, particularly in New York, are well known for being better at saying we have a goal of solving a problem than actually following through and solving the problem. How does this bill, for instance, deal with, you know, budgetary concerns, and does anything special kick in if, the say, after 5 years, progress is, you know, not adequate?
I think one thing that has been made clear to us in this process is that our policymakers do care about poverty. We hear them talk about it. We had the job over the last year of saying to them, we know you talk about this. We know you understand it's a problem. But each year goes by and we haven't done anything about it. We haven't really moved the needle. And I'll say that I'm thrilled that we had bipartisan support, including, you know, bipartisan sponsors of the bills and massive bipartisan rural, urban, suburban support for the bill itself. So there's a commitment to addressing this. But as you said, each year, our policymakers make decisions that may take us one step forward, but end up taking us two steps back. So what this does is asks our policymakers to look at all the budget and policy decisions that they're making in the context of the state budget and other policy decisions, and look at the sum total of those decisions. So those may be in tax policy, they may be in infrastructure policy, and they may be in any other number of policy areas. And one important component of the bill is that we're going to be publicly tracking progress over time. And each year when the executive budget is released, there's a period of time for assessing it. And then the advisory body that's associated with this legislation will assess the child poverty implications of the proposed budget. So looking across and kind of down deep into programs and what we can anticipate the implications are for child poverty.
You know, Governor Cuomo has to decide whether or not to sign the bill. And, there's certainly been cases in the recent past, including a wage theft bill, SWEAT, where he said, I generally agree with the goal, but want to change it a little bit. So I'm going to veto it and we'll talk about how to improve it. Do you have any indication yet, what the governor's going to do in terms of signing the bill? And would it be worthwhile, people concerned about childhood poverty, to possibly contact the governor to urge him to sign it?
It would be fantastic for people to contact the governor and ask that he sign the Child Poverty Reduction Act. And we know that the governor cares about child poverty. In his addresses during COVID, he talked about the challenges of child poverty. He talked about that we need to, that we really need to address it. And the reality is, we, as a state that, has historically had a lot of resources, even in a booming economy, we haven't addressed it. So this offers, arguably, the governor an opportunity to have a focused effort across government in addressing it. And yes, we are very hopeful that the governor will sign this. We don't know if the governor will sign it. We're super hopeful that he'll sign it. We had all but a few legislators voted in favor of it. So hopefully that will be a sign to the governor that there's very wide, broad, and deep support for it. And it's really a great vehicle for the governor to claim, some success that we're going to move forward and we're going to actually really do something about this.
Unfortunately, I'm now remembering the Decade of the Child by Governor Mario Cuomo, where we ended up joking, where is that one child that was saved during the decade? If people want more information about this bill, want more information about SCAA, how do they do that? Where can they find it?
Our website is scaany.org, and if you click on the child poverty link, there's a whole bunch of great resources there, and as well as ways to get in touch with our policymakers to let them know that this is an issue that you care about.
And I also noticed that on the website under releases, it does have a release about this particular bill. But Kay Breslin, I want to thank you for joining us. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. Two factoids, which we unfortunately forgot to mention, is one that the poverty rate for Black children, African-American children in New York State is twice as high as it is for white, also higher for Latinos versus white. And also the poverty rate for children under the age of 5 is actually even higher than in 1 in 5 for overall children. We'll keep an eye on whether the governor signed the bill, and we may have Kate back on if the bill signing drags on.
And next up, Ed Kanaan of Upstate Drone Action is one of several people whose criminal trials are for protesting at the Hancock Air Force Base outside Syracuse have been delayed due to COVID. Mark talks to Ed how drones are used to kill people in Afghanistan and now the courts have handled previous and how the courts have handled previous protests.
For our peace bucket, we're joined today by a prior guest, Ed Kanan, who's with Upstate Drone Action. We've had also John Amadon on talking about the various protests that have taken place at the Hancock Air Force Base outside of Syracuse, where the 174th attack wing is based, which pilots drones in Afghanistan and other parts of the Middle East. Ed will be eventually facing, we believe, some court trials because of prior arrests at protests. They've been shut down because of COVID. But Ed, maybe you could just briefly, you know, give us an update on what is Upstate Drone Action and why you have participated in these protests.
Okay. Upstate Drone Action Coalition is primarily focused on raising consciousness about the very serious problem of killer drones, the MQ-9 killer drone that is piloted from Hancock Air Base, which is on the edge of Syracuse, New York. They began about 10 years ago, and that's when Upstate Drone Action began, flying 24/7 over Afghanistan. One of their functions besides surveillance is assassination. And since this is in our backyard, we felt many of us responsible to expose this illegal, international illegal practice happening at Hancock and a number of other bases around the country and around the world, perpetrated by the U.S. Why am I involved? Well, partly it's in my backyard, so to speak. In my younger days, I could have walked out to the base, Hancock Air Base. But for many years, I've been an anti-war, anti-government terrorist activist, and this fits right in with that.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, you know, apparently a date for the trial of you and other protesters have not been set as we emerge from COVID. But I believe this is not your first trial. You know, what is the basic, you know, defense that you raise and, you know, how does the judge and possibly jury respond to it in general?
Well, the basic defense is that these drone strikes are immoral, they're illegal, they violate international law. They're not good for the U.S. people. I mean, it just stirs up hate around the world for the U.S. and leads to, blowback. We feel that, you know, as children of the era of the Nuremberg trials, which 1940s, which taught us that if you know your government is breaking the law, you have a responsibility to expose that. And if you can, even to impair it, get in the way of it. So that's what we've been trying to do for 10 years. Sometimes we go pro se, that is, we defend ourselves without being represented by an attorney because we want our voice, our conscience to be heard. Sometimes we're represented by pro bono attorneys. And since we've been arrested, maybe 200 times in terms of all the people been arrested out at Hancock, and some of us multiple times. And these arrests have sometimes led to dismissals of the charges. Sometimes they've led to jury trials. Sometimes they've just led to bench trials. And occasionally they lead to jail terms. And I've been in, you know, the Jamesville Penitentiary a number of times, as have a number of my Upstate Drone Action colleagues.
What, you know, indication do you have in terms of the upcoming trials? When may they take place? And are you going to try to get a jury trial? A jury trial is better in terms of their willingness to listen to the moral as well as legal arguments as opposed to just arguing before a judge. And I assume this is a local town justice?
Yes, exactly. It's hard to answer that question because the judges, we've had two judges over these 10 years. And so they've heard our arguments a number of times. And sometimes it seems like they're sort of impenetrable in terms of reaching them. And yet over the years, I think they've kind of softened as they've gotten to know us and to understand, that we're acting in good faith and that we're responsible U.S. citizens. So there has been some movement on their part. One of the judges even declared informally that he'd stop sending us to jail. Now, juries are a mixed bag, of course. We've had a number of jury trials, and they've gone both ways for us, either ways for us. So the process is also arbitrary, for one thing. Now, the charges that we currently have aren't, felonies, so we're not going to get a jury trial. So it'll be a bench trial. And when that'll be, we just don't know.
When it is a bench trial, is it, one evening for 45 minutes, you get the opportunity to call witnesses and have people testify? How does that work?
Well, it varies. It's very hard to pin down the rules here. Sometimes it's like, there's often multiple defendants, some of whom take the witness stand, some don't. We choose who our witnesses are, unless, of course, the prosecutor may call one of us as a witness. It's just a mixed bag.
So have you ever thought about running to be the town justice or get some other peace activist and run for town justice?
That's rich, Mark. I literally have never thought of running to be a town justice.
What can people do at this point? And, what other steps are you taking besides the jury trial to, draw attention to the problem of the drone pilots operating out of Hancock Air Force Base in the last 90 seconds?
Well, weekly demonstrations out at the base. We've had, I'm not sure the numbers now, but, over 100 demonstrations that weren't risking arrest out at the base, their signage. We're trying to reach the personnel on the base to make them aware that they're part of a death machine. We do get some media coverage, not as much as we'd want. I write the occasional op-ed, letters to the editor, that sort of thing. We've had a number of tactics locally to get attention to the drone issue.
Does it help for people to send letters to the town justice or anything?
I don't think it would hurt, depending on their tone. You don't want to alienate a judge needlessly. At this point in the trajectory of our trials, we're not calling for that. We don't need the judges to know more about us. We pretty much shared ourselves with the judges. I think they probably see us, whatever their lens is, as people of integrity. We're scrupulously nonviolent. So we've got a scrupulously nonviolent track record for these 10 years.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, we're out of time. The website is upstatedroneaction.org. We've been talking with Ed Canan. Any closing statement?
Let's abolish killer drones.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ed. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So for our listeners who have become addicted to endless reruns of Law and Order during COVID, we'll be keeping you up to date on the trials of Ed Canan and the rest of the Upstate Drone Action. And on Wednesday, we do have a regular Peace Bucket.
And for those of you just tuning in, You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Our next segment up is the primaries for Albany Common Council Democrats is June 22nd. Councilwoman Judith DeRoche is stepping down after two terms representing the 9th Ward off of New Scotland Avenue. Megan Keegan and Jolynn Gallagher are vying for the open seat. So Moses Nagel spoke with Megan Keegan about her campaign.
Megan Keegan, thanks for joining me. What led you to run for the Democratic nomination in the 9th Ward?
My roots are in activism. I was a social justice activist throughout my teens and early to mid-20s. And at some point, I decided that it would be more effective to get the right people elected into office who are going to actually be able to enact policy and enact change, and that was a more productive use of my time than continually marching in the streets. And so I became heavily involved with the Democratic Party. I served as the president of the Albany County Young Dems, and I've served on the Democratic Committee here in Albany since 2010. And I've helped a lot of really good Democrats get elected all over the Capital Region. I've helped launch first-time women and candidates of color all across the country. You know, so I feel like I've sort of been training for this job for well over 20 years.
What do you think are the most important issues facing your ward in the city of Albany?
What are we doing with police reform here in the city? The community policing is actually something that goes way back into my activist roots days, in the sort of the first vision of what community policing was going to be and the development of the Citizens Police Review Board. And we seem to be making some progress, and now we seem to be taking some steps backwards. I think I have a really unique background in terms of addressing that issue. The last 7 years of my career in state government, I was a civilian investigator on a multidisciplinary law enforcement team. I also grew up in a transracial family. I have an adopted sibling who is a 32-year-old Black man who's neurodivergent, has mental health issues and some physical disabilities. And so when we think about Black Lives Matter and we think about folks who we are concerned about having an interaction with police that could go terribly, tragically wrong, I've lived and breathed that for 32 of my 41 years. So I think I bring some really interesting perspectives to the table on that issue. I mean, I've worked with police all over the state. I've had cases that have resulted in arrests and successful prosecutions. I'm not a diehard. There's never a reason or purpose for law enforcement. But I also believe that there are some really significant issues around systemic racism that pervades our police department, and we need to be willing to have those conversations, and we need to be willing to make change on that issue in the community. Another big issue that I think particularly impacts my ward is climate change. We have significant stormwater overflow and rainwater-related flooding issues in various different parts of my district. So climate change and really thinking about how we do this in a smart way. And I would like to see legislation to really address actually assessing our infrastructure from a green and gray perspective whenever we're doing sidewalk repairs and road repairs, so that we're doing a better job of capturing rainwater and groundwater to sort of prevent stormwater overflow. And that feasibility assessment is at least incorporated into our infrastructure projects going forward. You know, the third big thing, which is also a citywide issue, but it's an issue that impacts our district, is really walkability and you know, ensuring that pedestrians and cyclists have safe and equitable access to roadways, particularly along the New Scotland corridor. There is a plan right now to restripe, repave, and sort of re-envision what New Scotland Avenue and New Scotland Road looks like once you get to Manning, which is sort of more in the 14th Ward and beyond. But that's really also a crucial pathway for our constituents. I mean, we are one of those communities that does have kids who play in the streets and run all over the neighborhood, which is wonderful that we still have that. But, you know, we certainly have some issues around pedestrian and cyclist safety in and along this corridor that I'd like to see us continue to address. And then the last thing would really be public safety. We do have, you know, sort of a spate of violent incidents happening in and around the one park that we have in this district. There's been a number of armed robberies there, and it's the police department's response to that has been, in my perspective, really disappointing. So, I mean, those would be kind of the big bucket list that I'd like to tackle. You know, the other things that are in the hopper for this council are going to be the closure of the landfill and redistricting. I understand Black Lives Matter, and I understand those issues, and I 100% believe folks when they say that they've had these experiences. But, you know, the bottom of the line on police reform, I think there's a couple of things that we need to also recognize. I mean, since the 90s, the Albany Police Department has been understaffed. We have been running on an overtime model. And I'm a social worker by trade. I worked in mental health, and then I went on to oversee the mental hygiene system. And so I have a lot of background in PTSD and trauma. And first responders face PTSD rates that are as high as folks who are returning from active combat zones. The way that our current staffing model works, they're already kind of set up at a deficit, where when they're coming into these high stressful situations, they just no longer have the capacity to respond the way we want them to. You know, I know folks are talking about defund the police. I wouldn't necessarily call for defunding the police. I would call for adequately staffing the police department. When we talk about things like the county's Accord program, you know, Albany Police has had a relationship with Mobile Crisis for a very long time. It's a great and wonderful service, but it is a service that is run by a nonprofit entity. They don't pay very well. They have a really hard time maintaining staffing. Mm-hmm. They're serving multiple different jurisdictions. So if your team is already engaged in a call, it could be hours before they mm-hmm. respond. And your officers are still there on the scene having to deal with this person, and they are not trained and equipped. And so what I would like to see is a police staffing model that looks a lot like the agency that I work for, where you have civilian staff who are stationed right within the department. Who have that expertise and are available to our city police officers, and who can respond directly with them on calls, so that they are the first people to arrive, and we're not dependent upon, you know, an outside entity to maybe have their team available or not available to us. I think I bring a lot of different stuff to the table in terms of my background and experience that will really lend to hopefully not only getting the, you know, agenda of the Black Lives Matter movement moving forward, but being done so in a way that, you know, we have buy-in from our officers, because without that, you're not going to see any significant change. I mean, we can put all the policies that we want to in place. If they're not actually going to be held accountable to those policies and they're not going to follow them,
right,
there's not going to be any active change in the community.
Right.
You know, and you're not going to get that by having a continually contentious relationship with your officers. At some point, you have to be willing to have a dialogue.
What is your favorite thing about living in Albany?
I really love that Albany is a diverse community. You know, we are a place that openly embraces new Americans and immigrants. We are a place that openly embraces our LGBTQIA community. We are, I think, making progress on being a community that is willing to at least recognize and address our history of racial oppression. So, you know, my decision to choose to move here, to live here 20 years ago, was really impacted by my experience of growing up in the suburbs and my experience of racism in the suburbs outside of Albany. And I wanted to be in a place where that was not going to be my experience where I lived. And so I chose to come here.
Primary early voting is underway now, and the primary is on June 22nd. Ms. Keegan's opponent, Jolynn Gallagher, was unable to speak for this story, but she says she's focused on making the city better for children. Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
So the Hudson Mohawk Magazine does try to give any of the candidates running in our listening audience area the opportunity to speak before the June 22nd primary, if you're involved in the primary. So do reach out to the Media Sanctuary if you would like us to interview you.
Now, Juneteenth is the celebration of freedom of enslaved persons of color in the United States. On June 19th, Albany will be celebrating Juneteenth when finally all slaves, including those in Texas, were freed in the country. Sina Basila Hickey spoke with Trayvon T. Jackson, Executive Director of the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region.
This Saturday, June 19th, there will be a Juneteenth celebration hosted by the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region. Joining me to talk about this event is Trayvon Jackson, Executive Director of the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What can you tell us about the event happening this weekend?
Yes. So this Juneteenth celebration is our 17th annual in the city of Albany and the fourth in the South End neighborhood. It is the celebration of freedom for enslaved persons of color in the United States. It was on June 19th, 1865, that General Gordon Granger delivered Order Number 3 with Union troops to the South, declaring that those persons were in fact free.
So what can the public expect when they go to this event this weekend?
Absolutely. Well, they can expect a friendly, welcoming environment. That's because we'll be closing off South Pearl Street from Madison to Morton and encouraging the neighbors and residents to come out and celebrate with us. There will also be 30 to 40 vendors on the street, as well as our reflection garden with live performances and outdoor art installations and murals above our reflection ponds with our rescue turtles. There are kids programs as well on the interior of the building, as long as our permanent exhibitions. And there are other activities and parking facilities available adjacent at the South End Grocery.
So it's going to be a mix of both educational activities and entertainment, such as, the vendors, you have places to shop. There is a movie night. And I also heard there's a libation ceremony, which many of our listeners may not be familiar with. Could you talk about what are the opportunities to see something a little bit different this weekend?
Yeah. So with respect to, you know, libation ceremonies, those are most commonly used for Kwanzaa. With respect to Juneteenth, our ceremony specifically is to open with remarks and induction, as well as Lift Every Voice and Sing. And that is our celebration and opening ceremony. With regards to other things you may not expect, many people do not spend time in the South End neighborhood for recreational purposes. And I think that will go a long way towards helping understand the beauty and the vibrancy of the neighborhood and the existing residents and businesses that are there.
So you mentioned that this is the 17th year that the Juneteenth celebration is happening in Albany. How have you noticed the public understanding of Juneteenth and the history of enslaved people in the U.S. changing over time?
I would say it's been very gradual and stagnant in many respects. I think in terms of education, you know, I do these news runs and pressers every year. And a lot of it is the same education by and large for the masses. And the average person is not deeply aware of the struggle, the degradation, and the slavery that was subjected to persons of color and the oppressed in this country. And it's events like these that provide the opportunity for the deeper knowledge and education so that you can affect those who are open and receptive to building a congenial bond.
Is the African American Cultural Center also involved in public school education or any school education? Are there programs that are happening in our school system to make people more aware of this history?
Yeah, we do direct outreach with the school districts and schools on an individual basis. At a district-wide level, of course, that would need to be implemented in a greater magnitude to catch on. But of course, with COVID impacting our educational system in the last year, much of the progress and traction of those conversations is starting anew.
Is there one piece that you find is most important to understand when we talk about Juneteenth and the history of enslaved people? What do you feel like is the most important piece for the public to understand and that maybe is less talked about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think with respect to what is or is not talked about, you know, you're dealing with a population that is largely ignorant to the meaning. So there's not much context to compare to in that respect. I think one thing that should be taken away is that it is a celebration of freedom of peoples. And that was independent from freedom as it was determined in this country. The entire point and purpose of this holiday is in fact history. It is the history of an event in this country that impacts the majority of persons who claim some type of African descent. So I believe that it is very important to understand the people that we share borders, homes, neighborhoods, restaurants, and space with beyond the cursory experience.
Is there something that you would really like to see change to further public understanding? Is there, what are some things that you would like to see implemented, whether it be in the education system or just public understanding or events happening in the Capital Region?
I think there are a variety of events that happen in the Capital Region. I mean, obviously, for an educational standpoint, I would prefer a more expansive discussion than just Juneteenth. You know, I'll trade some Juneteenth awareness for a deeper understanding that correctly depicts the civil rights movement and accurately depicts some of the spying and techniques that they were subjected to by the federal government of the United States. Because with that context, it becomes much easier and much more fluid to understand and empathize with things and concepts like Juneteenth that predate all of us that are currently alive. So that, I believe, is really a key unique point for reflection. But it's a much broader initiative, and I would not pretend that is an easy endeavor for a school district or any other party. That's why we exist where we do, to try and fill the gaps.
If listeners are interested to coming to the African American Cultural Center, first, what are the restrictions right now? Are people able to visit the center? And when it is open, what can the public see and learn at your center?
Yeah, so people can visit now. You just have to ring the bell. Of course, we'll do a temperature check and observe social distancing, and you can ultimately indicate your level of comfort with disclosing vaccination status. However, we do not force those questions. We can social distance and adequately comply with the regulations while maintaining that level of privacy. Once you're inside, of course, we have our permanent exhibitions and our redone first and second floor gallery spaces. This also includes music and performance spaces, as well as private workspaces for artists and residents who produce ongoing works and shows, and they have studio space that is provided for them at no cost. So there are a variety of things to enjoy when you come to the African American Cultural Center.
Is there currently an exhibition, an art exhibition happening, the Herstory?
Yes, there's always an exhibition. But yes, Herstory is still up, but actually was just moved within the building because we have mounted another new installation that will be debuted at Juneteenth. This is an artist, Tai Tan. These are three-dimensional installations that depict visually what urban life is for those in Albany, New York, and beyond when you identify with the African-American experience.
Wonderful. What is the website? How can our listeners find more information about the African American Cultural Center?
Yeah, so the website is www.theaaccr.org. And on the website, you can see some of the brief elements of history. It collects all of our social media channels and information about our events and programs. And of course, if you want to learn more about what we propose to the public, and that is the history and contribution of African Americans, we have artifacts, books, and collections here on site that we can review either virtually or can discuss in person should you choose to visit.
Great. And how do our listeners find out more information about the Juneteenth event happening this weekend?
Yes, yeah, so you could visit our website, visit our Facebook page. Of course, we will have some new stories running very shortly on Spectrum and other networks that'll provide even more detail. And our print ad just ran in this Sunday's Times Union newspaper with a full outline of our programming.
Wonderful. Anything else that needs to be added into this conversation?
That we welcome all individuals who consider themselves allies to our movement to bring love and congeniality to all peoples and do that with a context and understanding of our unique struggle as African Americans. So we hope to see you and welcome you on Saturday to accomplish just that.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that was Sino with Trayvon Jackson of the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region. Should also note lots of other Juneteenth celebrations. The Myers Residence in Arbor Hill with the Underground Railroad Education Center will have an open house. And in Schenectady, the Hamilton Hill Art Center will hold a two-way event, actually starting at the Vale Cemetery with the program to honor their ancestors, followed by an ice cream social, and then a larger celebration the next day from 1 to 8 p.m. in Central Park in Schenectady.
Black Lives Matter activist Muhammad Abdi of Burlington, Vermont, was interviewed by Brendan Meslauskas Dunn during a rally in support of the Spring Revolution in Burma. Abdi took a deep dive into the politics of race, activism, and revolutionary struggle in Vermont.
Tell me a little bit about organizing in Vermont, and as someone that's an organizer in Vermont, what's that experience like?
Well, I'm very new to the organizing community. I've been in it for about a year now, and prior to organizing, I kind of seen things happening around me, but in terms of just the place that I'm from, which is Vermont, there wasn't really that much stuff going on in terms of demonstration. I believe for some reason, Vermont was just not very active, especially even after the murdering of George Floyd. So I'm a part of this organization called, I'm actually one of the co-founders of this organization called The Black Perspective, and we're based in Vermont. And we started off demonstrating, you know, just doing demonstration in Vermont, and it's been very successful. We've had over, you know, 1,000 people show up to our demonstration, and that was like start off. You know, we had no prior experience demonstrating, but like it was very successful, and we knew that we had the skills. So we just continue on doing that for a while. Then slowly what we started doing was like, okay, we got to focus on education too. You know, I believe like after people go home, they still need to go home and know what to do when they go home. After you're done chanting Black Lives Matter, what do you do? What do you do inside your house? What are the conversations about? You know, who do you need to talk to? Because really, we have to understand the people that are doing this this damage, the people that are working in the system, do have family members. They're not people that are aliens. They're human beings. They have brothers and sisters, and their brothers and sisters are probably attending Black Lives Matter protests. So you should also be talking to your uncle, who is a police officer, that's probably a part of the system that is destroying black people and minorities in general.
And tell us specifically what kind of organizing, what kind of actions have you all been doing in Burlington and Vermont over the last year?
Of course, yes. So we started off obviously with the demonstrations, and then slowly we started doing community events, and then we did a encampment at Battery Park, Burlington, Vermont. We did a month-long encampment, and it was very successful. We got one officer fired, but we wanted three of them fired, but we only got one, and it was good for one. You know, it's like it's whatever. We didn't really think there was going to be that much success because of the fact that we just thought the police were not going to listen to us. But it was successful. We did it for a month. We got one officer fired. But what was going on within that encampment that was also very beautiful was that we were doing mutual aid. We were taking care of the homeless community, and we were feeding them, and we were feeding anyone that really came to the park. So that was something that was beautiful about the encampment. We were, just educating everybody that came to the encampment. People slept there. Whoever that could slept there. Whoever that didn't want to sleep there, they came when there were demonstrations. Like, we had like a schedule for daily activities, so people knew what was happening and when it was happening, and it was very organized. And the best part was it was ran 100% by black people, meaning there were white people all over the spot, but we just made the decision to decenter white leadership, and everybody was okay with that. And it was great. We were not, abusing white people there. Everybody was working together. We made sure that everybody was treated fairly and equally. But it was beautiful. It was a great environment. And, you can definitely read about it. It was the Battery Park encampment in Burlington, Vermont.
Can you talk about some of the challenges that face black people in particular in Vermont, and also black activists and organizers? I know Vermont is a majority white state. And that's not to ignore the, diversity of, folks that do live there. But it also has, I think, too, a lot of people see Vermont as a uniquely very, like, progressive state. But that might also cover up a lot of the, the racism and the history of that in Vermont. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it is true. People view Vermont to be very progressive. But the reality is completely different. I have seen people get mistreated by the police department numerous times, and there was no action that was taken to give those individuals justice. And one of the main reasons why those individuals were not given justice is because we just did not cover it. And I mean, honestly, I'm gonna have to try to just like name drop some of the people that were involved. It's going to have to be the media. I think the media plays a huge role in this. So when there is, this incident where there's clearly racism, the media would not cover it because people don't want to read about that. And so for that reason, people don't even know that it's happening. And then in addition, like, obviously, even if the media doesn't cover it, injustice is injustice. It doesn't have to go into the media for people for it to be deemed as injustice. I think that is very clear. But obviously that just shows where they stand in terms of like their default behavior when it comes to racism, which is to not address it. So Vermont is definitely a state that needs to definitely change its way.
More recently, there's been an upsurge of protests in the U.S. and also around the world, specifically in response to, apartheid in Israel and Palestine and the Israeli military assault on Palestinians and ethnic cleansing there. In the background, we can both hear Burmese revolutionary songs that are being sung. We're here just outside of a Burmese rally in Utica, organized by the peoples from Burma, Myanmar, who live here in Utica in solidarity with their revolution at home. Can you talk a little more about, there's Palestine, there's Burma, all these other issues, and how are they related? How are they connected? Where do you see that connection?
Well, I believe in something that's called collective liberation. So obviously when black people needed support from the community, the general world, people came out and protested and supported us, especially when George Floyd was murdered. That is not a one-way thing. And what I mean by that is black people are going to have to do the same for other communities. Just because the person that got murdered wasn't black doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a black problem. Because it's the system that murdered that, even, for example, white person, was the same system that murdered that black person. Because when you really look into this issue, There's also class involved. So even poor immigrants, poor white people, all of them are all involved in this situation. And they're all people that are going to be needing our support. And we have to come together to dismantle this general system. And, you know, obviously race is a huge problem, but class and also obviously our immigration system is it's all just the same. And black people are going to have to take the stand and support all these different other issues, even outside of America, because if we're going to expect other people to say Black Lives Matter, then we're going to have to, you know, do the same thing for other people that are saying our lives matter, too. You know, I think that just makes sense. So collective liberation is something that is very important. And black people are going to have to support all these other problems, because together we're going to get exactly what we want.
And I want to dig a little deeper at just your personal thoughts on the past year specifically. I mean, you said yourself you're a newer activist, newer organizer. Black Lives Matter is really the largest upsurge in rebellion of sorts since the rebellion of the 1960s and 70s in this country. It's not as big as it was, say, last summer when it started, but, you know, as you're showing in Burlington, Vermont, organizing is still going on. But a lot's happened this year with the rebellion, with the, you know, killings from police officers, with the pandemic and all these other things. I mean, as someone that's newer in this movement, how do you keep going without getting burnt out?
Well, you gotta have allies. First things first, this job does not pay. You don't get paid to be an activist. I'm sorry. It just doesn't happen. You just have to have the passion, and you're just gonna have to have the will. I mean, even not just an activist, also the people that are also involved in the activist community, like obviously reporters and photographers. They're all individuals that might not be getting as much money as they should, especially to cover something like this, because of the fact that it's just, there's no system in place that will support this. Actually, the system is against you doing something like that, because you're going against them. So it's very unfortunate. But for me, as a new activist, the way I deal with it is by surrounding myself with the right people, and making sure that I'm taking a step back when I need to just like, you know, just like focus on myself, do something different that is not the type of work that I'm doing right now. Because I think that is very important. You can't just be on this type of work 24/7, because you're gonna have mental health is something that is very important within activism. Like, people don't want to take the step back because they believe that if they take a step back, the revolution is gonna be slowed down. But really, in reality, the revolution will never slow down. You have to take a step back so that the revolution can keep going. So you have to take that step back. You know, I think it's very important. So mental health is very important. Surrounding yourself with the right people and making sure that you're a part of some sort of coalition, some sort of system, so that you guys can at least find a way to fund yourselves. Because really, you still have bills to pay. You still have, you know, things that you have to pay for. So being in a coalition is going to help at least create some sort of a source of income for you to support yourself. But yes, it's just like surrounding yourself with the right people, taking a step back. Mental health is very important. And, you know, at the end of the day, really, you're the most important part of this whole situation. So you have to make sure you take care of yourself, because we need you to be at your best self so that you can perform at your best and give the best speech, you know. So it's very important for you to take care of yourself. So self-care it is.
So that was Black Lives Matter activist Muhammad Abdi of Burlington, Vermont, talking about the movement, organizing, and revolutionary struggle in the state of Vermont.
And, well, that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Conliff.
I'm Mark Dunley. Our engineer was Sina Basila Hickey.
So tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. And until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.